Jesus took the opportunity to talk with his disciples and teach them a lesson, actually a couple of lessons, about seeing past the physical. There was a tendency that we all still have as we see what's in front of us and we don't necessarily see what else is going on. He told them that he had food to eat they didn't know about, and he was speaking about doing the will of God and how refreshing it is, actually, more important than physical food, more refreshing than physical food, is doing the will of God. And that's where Jesus found his sustenance. He then also pointed them that there was a harvest coming. The barley, the wheat, would have been green at that time of year, but he said the fields are white unto harvest. Why? Because some of the people from Sychar were already coming. Contrast in their clothing to the white fields, a harvest of eternal life that they would be able to take part in. God places us together. Some sow, some reap. But all of us rejoice in the harvest, don't we? And he was pointing that out to his disciples. Well, according to John chapter 4, starting in verse 40 through 43, at their request, Jesus stayed with the Samaritans in Sychar for 2 extra days. He then resumed his journey up to Galilee. And as John continues his account in verse 44, he explains the reason that he had gone back up to Galilee. It's actually not the reason he left Sychar, because it isn't. It's why he's going to Galilee. If you would look at John 4 and see verses 4 through 42 as sort of a ellipsis about an event that happened on the way to Galilee, it's a little easier to see that. If you put verse 3 together and then jump all the way to 44, it would be, he left Judea and departed into Galilee, then jump to the events in Sychar, and then it says, for Jesus himself testified, a prophet has no honor in his own country. Recall the reason that Jesus left Judea is that the Pharisees had become aware that his ministry was surpassing that of John the Baptist. And with that kind of attention would come antagonism, and Jesus left to avoid antagonism. It was not yet the time to cause that kind of antagonism to rise. As he went through Samaria, he found greater faith than he did in Judea, and hence his statement here in verse 44, a prophet has no honor in his own country. The Samaritans, not his own country, gave him greater honor. Well, in verse 45, we find he gets back to Galilee. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things that he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they themselves also went to the feast. So the Galileans paid attention to him when he got back up there. And the passage then continues on, but we find that it's going to be a mixed reception because there's varying motives among the people. Many of the Galileans had already met Jesus. They'd seen what he did during the previous Passover, but that's 8 months earlier. But they do not respond the same way as the Samaritans do. There are some things they are looking for. Verse 48 is going to allude to their interest revolving around seeing additional miracles and waiting to see those things before they themselves would believe. And so that is why there is a lack of honor among even the Galileans to Jesus compared to the Samaritans. Some will, most will not. He is famous, though, at this point, and so he starts receiving invitations to go to the very synagogues and teaching in them, and his fame is spreading around the whole region. Look at verse 46. He came, therefore, again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water into wine. There was a certain royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and was requesting him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So the first place he goes back once he gets to Galilee is Cana of Galilee. Now, Capernaum is on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. Cana of Galilee is about 16 miles southwest of there. You have to go up over the hills, through a pass, and then over to Cana of Galilee. Now, this miracle that Jesus had done in Cana of Galilee, we looked at that probably about a month or two ago, is a miracle of the first order. It is something that only God could do. It's no sleight of hand. Jesus turned water into wine. That requires the instant creation or reformulation of the very elements in the water jar. Water consists of two elements, hydrogen and oxygen. But wine also contains very complex molecules that are made up of elements of carbon, nitrogen, potassium, sodium, iron, sulfur, chlorine, and phosphorus. So again, it's a miracle of the first order. It's not sleight of hand. He didn't throw something in the water. The servants went and got the water and brought it back, and he said, just dip out of it. Jesus never touched it. Now, John's purpose is to demonstrate that Jesus is God. That's why he's writing his book, that he is the Son of God. He is the Messiah. Only Messiah, only the Son of God could do something of this order, this miracle. So while Jesus is in Cana, he's now returned there. It's many months later, 8-9 months after he had performed this first miracle. A Jewish man who served as a royal official, probably to Herod Antipas, he lived in Capernaum, 16 miles away. He hears that Jesus returned to Galilee. Now, this man probably had been at Passover. He knows something about Jesus. He knows he can work miracles. His son is sick, says sick unto death. Could Jesus heal him? It's worth it to him. He travels the 16 miles. He's desperate. And we can well imagine all that a father would have done already by this time. He would have called the doctors. He would have consulted the local rabbis. He'd done everything he could. His child is nearing death. He's desperate. What else can I do? He hears about Jesus. I will make that trip. Now, 16 miles to us is no big deal. We get in our car, we're gone. Walking 16 miles, a little different, especially since you're going to have to go over some hills to begin with. But he's going to make the trip. Maybe he can get Jesus, bring him back, and the son will be spared. When he arrives, he pleads with Jesus, come back to Capernaum, heal my son. And again, every parent here can understand the urgency of this man's request. Jesus responds, though, in verse 48. Seems a little harsh at first. But he's going to bring out something in this man, some greater faith. It says, Jesus therefore said to him, unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply will not believe. Now, signs and wonders are the miracles that are signs of divine activity. They also astonish people, and they want to see these things. The grammar here, though, is that they would not have any faith in Jesus unless they continually saw signs of miracle. They don't just want one. Some had seen those things in Jerusalem. They want this to continue on. I want more and more and more of them. In addition, there is apparently a crowd present because there's a man, one guy, he comes and he talks to Jesus, but Jesus' answer here is in the plural, you, plural, all of you. There's a crowd there. So he's addressing more than just the man. And that is what the crowd wanted. We want to see miracles. Now, it would be contrary to Jesus' character of compassion to make such a statement to a man to put him off. That's just not his character. But to the crowd, he needs to make this clear. This is, I understand, is what you're looking for. So it appears to be more of a rebuke to the crowd than anything else. But it also is a clarification of a fallacy that's in this man's mind. Again, the crowd wants to see miracles, and they apparently believe that Jesus can do miracles. But they did not yet believe Jesus' claim to be the Messiah, to be the Son of God, really, or even to be a prophet. They might think he's some kind of prophet, but what is he yet? They don't know. Is he really who he's claiming to be? We're not going to believe until we see his miracles. Now, that could have been the mindset of this man. The text doesn't tell us. But his concern, very obvious within the text, is the life of his child. Whether it's Jesus or Messiah or not, he's not concerned about. I'm concerned about the life of my child. I do believe he can do something. He can heal my child. But from what it says here, in verse 49, the urgency here, sir, come down before my child dies. That's his response to Jesus' statement. My child, come. He apparently believes Jesus can heal the child, but only if Jesus goes with him all the way back to Capernaum. He thinks Jesus has to be present to be able to perform this healing. Now again, every parent here, you and I would do the same, wouldn't you? We would. Jimmy, you're a brand new father. If your son was sick, what would you do? Everything. And you're just now getting the understanding of what babies are really all about. Poop and spit up. All right. Am I correct? Yeah, okay. Welcome to fatherhood. But you would do anything for that baby. And that's a brand newborn. And the more years you have with that child, the more you'll do anything. You love your child. So his urgency, I'm not concerned about what anybody else saying. Come with me, heal my child. Sir, come before my child dies. Well, Jesus is going to respond, and it's a very simple statement. Look at verse 50. Jesus said to him, go your way, your son lives. That's it. That's his response. Go your way, your son lives. Very direct statement. You cannot tone this down like your child is going to live. Your child will get better. Be warm and be filled. Someday he'll be better. You can't tone this down. It's a direct declaration based on Jesus' omniscience and omnipotence. Go your way, your son lives. When he left, he was about to die. He lives. I declared it to be so. Now, Jesus in Cana Galilee, the son's in Capernaum, is 16 miles away. Now, the man had taken to heart the earlier rebuke Jesus gave, and so he responds in a very positive manner to Jesus' words. Look at verse 51. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he started off. I believe what he said. I'm going to go home. And he hadn't seen Jesus do anything. All Jesus said is, go your way. Your son lives. So he starts off. Verses 51 through 53 gives us the rest of the story. And as he was now going down, his slaves met him, saying that his son was living. So he inquired of them the hour when he began to get better. They said, therefore, to him, yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him. So the father knew that it was at the hour in which Jesus said to him, your son lives, and he himself believed in his whole household. When you have to walk, 16 miles is a long way. So as soon as Jesus says, go your way, your son lives, he heads for home. But it's going to take him a while to get there. The following day, he runs into his servants who are coming to get him to let him know your son is good. He's healthy. He's living. Well, what happened? When did it happen? And he ascertains from them it was the seventh hour, the very time when Jesus stated it. It's not happenstance. It's not coincidence. It's because of what Jesus said. The result was this man's faith was even stronger. He now sees the two tied together. What Jesus said, he believed, and now it's confirmed. Just exactly what Jesus said. And based on his testimony to his family, the whole household, that's his kids, everybody in his household, his slaves, they all believe him. They also place their faith that Jesus is who he's claiming to be. He is the Messiah. He has these abilities. He's capable. He's the Son of God. John 5:54 then states, this again a second sign that Jesus performed when he had come out of Judea into Galilee. And again, a miracle of the first order. This is not something anybody can do. There is no therapy because Jesus is not present. 16 miles is a long ways. No therapy. He gave the man no medication. Man wasn't there anyways to give any medication. And interestingly, the rabbis claim to be able to heal through prayer. But notice here, Jesus doesn't even pray. Very interesting. He did not even pray. He simply declared it. That's how he healed him. He simply declared it to be so. Only God can do that. Now, because the Apostle John wrote his gospel account with an emphasis on presenting Jesus as the Son of God, and then jumping around, he does not give a chronology, he'll jump around with the different evidences that demonstrate that. In John 5, he jumps to the next spring. So we're not going to continue on with John 5. John often will skip areas that are covered in other gospel accounts, and such is the case here. Luke 4, please turn over to Luke chapter 4, gives us an account of what happens next. What does Jesus do after he was in Cana of Galilee? He's healed this boy from 16 miles away. What happens next? John 5 ends up in the Passover the following spring. Look at Luke 4, starting in verse 14, is a summary of Jesus' ministry before going to Nazareth. It simply says, "And Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread through all the surrounding district, and he began teaching in their synagogues and was praised by all." That's what Jesus did. Luke skips and doesn't mention anything about what happened on the way to Galilee, what John covers in great detail. He just states, Jesus returned to the region of Galilee, but it specifically states here, in the power of the Spirit. Jesus did not do anything outside the power of the Spirit. All of his ministry was done in the power of the Spirit. Lots of verses back that up. It's always by the Father's will according to the leading of the Spirit. Even when he went into the desert for temptation, it was by what? The leading of the Spirit. That was after he was anointed by the Spirit. The Spirit came down upon him at his baptism. This is the direction that Jesus is going. This is how he's doing it. It's always in the power of the Spirit. And as already pointed out from John 4:45, the Galileans had received Jesus positively because Jesus had done so many miracles during the Passover season. This healing of the royal official's son would have been news had been spread around, and any other unrecorded miracles that he had done. And so his fame is quickly spread throughout the region. And when a well-known rabbi is in the area, the local synagogue will invite him to come in, to read the scriptures, and to speak. That is what is happening now. Throughout the region of Galilee, Jesus speaking in the synagogues. People were receiving him very favorably. It started that way when he gets back to his hometown in Nazareth. Now, Nazareth is about 6 miles south of Cana, and probably also about 16 miles from Capernaum, or the Sea of Galilee. That's the area that he had been in. He goes to Nazareth. He's been working his way around the area. But this is his hometown. Look at verse 16. It says, "And he came to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Sabbath and stood up to read. And the book of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him, and he opened the book and found the place where it was written, 'The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord.' And he closed the book, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And the eyes of all of them in the synagogue were fixed on him, and he began to say to them, 'Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing.' And all were speaking well of him and wondering at the gracious words which were falling from his lips. And they were saying, 'Is this not Joseph's son?'" Now at this point, Jesus is the local boy who's done well. He's achieved fame. He's now then considered a favorite son of the town. And any of you who've traveled around, you've seen these signs. You're coming into a town and it has something up says, "Welcome to the hometown of so-and-so," or "the birthplace of so-and-so," or "the hometown of some team," right? I've done extensive traveling in this nation. I've seen those signs a lot. Now, most of the time, I have no idea who so-and-so are and know nothing about whatever team they think is so great. But to the hometown, this is good. This is somebody famous because people are still like that. We'd like to achieve fame for ourselves by the fame of somebody else. I must be something special because I grew up in the same place as so-and-so did. Right? Isn't that still going on? Don't you feel proud? No, it's only Wappingers Falls. What are we famous for? Tawana Brawley? No. Oh, that brings up the other point. If you're going to put up the sign, wait until they're dead. Because what happens if they do something really bad? You either have to take down the sign or you have to endure the embarrassment of it. Okay? So Jesus is in his hometown. He's famous. We're going to receive him well. He's a local boy that's done well. He's a popular rabbi, and that's the kind of positive response we get in verse 22. But this text also reveals to us some customs of the synagogue to the time of Christ. Now, first, the people would gather together on the Sabbath to hear the scriptures read and explained as part of their worship of God that day. That was part of it. The word synagogue itself simply means an assembly or a gathering of people. It came to be used also to designate the location or the building in which these people gathered. The word ekklesia, which we translate as church in the New Testament, assembly of Christians, is used the same way. It's used for the people, and sometimes it's also used for the facility in which they meet. But they would gather together, a synagogue would gather together in order to worship God. Now, the synagogue was the center of Jewish social life. In fact, it's interesting, even in Jerusalem, which had a temple, had hundreds of synagogues. That's where it was broken down to small groups where those are your friends. Those are the people that help you. That is what's important. That's your social life is revolving around that. That's why in the Old Testament, when you have several places where it talks about certain sins and being cut off from the people, you're cut off from being able to gather with them. Makes sin very serious. But that's what they've done. That's their habit. They'll gather together. They're in a synagogue. Or gather together as a synagogue. Another custom is that the honor of reading from the scriptures and explaining them was often given to a visiting rabbi, in this case it's Jesus. The rabbi would ask for the scroll that contains a particular passage he wants to read, and then after he finds the place, he'd stand up and he'd read it. Now, you need to remember, they don't have books like we have. We have books, we cut leaves, bind them together, and we can flip through and find things. They don't. They have scrolls. You roll them out. And then you have to keep rolling until you find the right place, and you read that section. They also did not have scriptures that are divided up into chapters and verses. In fact, chapter divisions are not added till the 13th century, apparently either by a guy named Cardinal Hug or Archbishop Langdon. And the verse divisions are not added until the printer Robert Stevens did so in 1551. We'd have that in our Bibles because it makes it easy to find something. Hey, go. Where's John 3:16? Oh, John chapter 3:16. Find it real fast. Find the place where it says, and you quote it, and you're not sure where you can find it. So he finds a place where he wants to read from Isaiah, and he begins to read. He stands up, it tells us, to read it. Now, that is their custom. I don't know how far back that goes. I do know by the time of Nehemiah, it is the standard practice. When the Word of God is read, they will stand up for it. When Ezra read the law, he stood up, and all the people stood up with him while he read it. It's part of honoring the Word. That's one reason why we have you stand through the point in our service where we read the Scriptures. It's following the same custom. So Jesus was handed the scroll, he stood up, found the place he wanted, and then he read it. Now, after the rabbi finished reading the text, he'd hand the scroll back to the tenant who kept them. He would then sit down to explain what he read. I have to admit, in about 10 years, I'm probably going to start that custom. Sounds pretty good some days. I think I'll sit down. But that was their custom. They sit down to teach. Now, he follows his custom. He's rolled the scroll out. He's read. And this section's from Isaiah. He sat down, and it says, the eyes of all the synagogue are fixed on him. What's he going to say? What's he going to say about this passage? Now, Jesus begins to give his sermon regarding the text, but he is stopped short by their response. He gets as far as stating, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. That's as far as he gets. At that point, people erupt in talking and commenting to each other. The text says their response is speaking well of him, so they're talking to each other, wondering at the gracious words which were falling from his lips, and then saying, is this not Joseph's son? So they interrupt him right as he just began. People still do that. But they interrupt him so he doesn't get any farther. Now, the particular passage Jesus read from Isaiah is a section concerning the future restoration of the nation of Israel. Her oppressors are going to be thrown off, and she is going to be restored to her former glory. And righteousness is going to reign under God's gracious hand. That's that section. Most of those who heard Jesus would be familiar with it. And these are people who knew their Bible well. So he starts reading this, and they're immediately go, oh, I know where he's reading. I know what that's all about. This is a wonderful section. It's about our future. And they recognize that Jesus is stating that he is somehow the messenger of this good news, this prophecy starting to be fulfilled right now, and so they're happy about it. But that's also why they're astonished. They're happy, but wait a minute. Joseph's son? Their question there is rhetorical. It's not a question of his identity. They knew who it was. They knew this was Joseph's son. But they're amazed. Could Joseph's son really be the one who's now a rabbi and he's teaching this and he's saying somehow he's part of this fulfillment of this prophecy? However, in their wonder, in their joy, they failed to recognize three important points about what Jesus already said. The first is they failed to notice that Jesus only quoted a very, very, very small section or portion of this whole section dealing with the future restoration of Israel. It's only a verse and a half. He only quotes the section that speaks of the good news for Zion about the blessings that are going to come upon those who are afflicted and brokenhearted and captured or prisoners, what they're going to receive. And they're going to be comforted and healed and set free to live in liberty. It was the beginning of the favorable year of the Lord, the ultimate jubilee. That's all great, exciting stuff. It's good news. And for them, it would also be good news if he had continued on and talked about the vengeance of God and the punishment of the surrounding nations. But Jesus doesn't even mention the next phrase, which starts talking about the vengeance of God. He stops before he gets there. He doesn't mention any of that. Jesus was not proclaiming that this was the beginning of the fulfillment of the entire prophecy of Isaiah, but only a part of it. And that part which began with the arrival of Messiah, but that's the second point they fail to recognize. Jesus is making that very claim. Remember, Luke began this passage stating that Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit. The very first two phrases of Isaiah 61 deals with the same issue. And Jesus said this was being fulfilled in your hearing. It says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel, and then goes on with what he's going to say. Remember that Messiah, or in Greek, the Christ, simply means the anointed one, the one who prophesied to come that be anointed by God. Jesus is stating that he is that anointed one by the Spirit, fulfilling the prophecy of Isaiah. That's his claim. But they missed it. The third point they failed to recognize was the timing of this prophecy being fulfilled. Jesus stated it was today, and that it was being fulfilled in their hearing. The verb here is in the perfect tense. It means it's started to being fulfilled and it will continue to be fulfilled in your hearing if you'll listen. It's right now. But they missed that point as well. If they had recognized these points, they would not have reacted the way they do at the end of the sermon, in which they actually become an angry and murderous mob. They would have been appalled at their own behavior, and then, like the Samaritans, they would have believed Jesus and pleaded with him to stay and teach them more. That is not what they're going to do. They stop Jesus right at the beginning of the sermon, and they're happy. Wow, this is great. And wow, it's Joseph's son? Really? Joseph's son's doing this? But that's going to change very rapidly. Jesus now begins the rest of his sermon. Look at verse 23. He said to them, no doubt you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Whatever we heard was done at Capernaum, do here in your own hometown as well. He said, truly I say to you, no prophet is welcome in his hometown or accepted in his hometown. But I say to you in truth, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah when the sky was shut up for 3 years and 6 months, when a great famine came over all the land. And yet Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. Jesus begins the application section of this sermon by quoting an old proverb. It's not a biblical proverb. It's just a proverbial statement. It's a common phrase, described the necessity of a physician demonstrating he actually was credentialed or could do what he's saying by keeping himself healthy. Let's face it, the physician cannot heal himself. Would you really trust him to heal you? All right, you see the point. And so it was a very common saying that if you make a claim, there needs to be something that you do that proves the claim is true. That's the point of it. He's letting them know, I understand, because here's the direct connection. You are expecting me to do something. I have just proclaimed I'm Messiah. I've been saying that I am the anointed one. And now you expect that I am going to do miracles to prove it to you. That'd be my credentials. A rabbi, prophet, the spirit-anointed messenger, spoken about in the prophecy Isaiah. You want me to do miracles. Prove my claim. So he says that. Here's the proverb. This is what you're looking for. Now, Luke does not state what Jesus had done in Capernaum, but we've already seen our study of John 4 earlier this morning, that while Jesus was in Cana of Galilee, he had healed the son of the royal official, though the boy was still in Capernaum. They are looking for Jesus to do a miracle of the same type. Do something similar to that, but not just one, because we already saw the tense earlier was you can keep doing these miracles. Keep proving it. One's not enough. They already knew about this one. They already knew about the testimonies of it by many people, but they want him to do more miracles. They would not believe until they could see with their own eyes Jesus do such things. So Jesus is very pointed with them in calling their attention to a general truth, one certainly applicable in this situation, that people of a town will not accept one of their own townsmen as a prophet. They were already astonished that Joseph's son was the one speaking as a rabbi. People are much quicker to recognize greatness in a stranger than someone they may know well. Later on, the people of Nazareth won't even call him Joseph's son. They won't even get that personal. It's the carpenter's son, with some disdain. Just a carpenter's son, a nobody. Jesus then illustrates this point with two examples from Jewish history, and that drives in the point. The first example is that of Elijah. This takes place in 1 Kings 17. Some of you may be familiar with the story. But Jesus said, I say to you in truth, that there were many, many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the sky was shut up for 3 years and 6 months, when a great famine came over the land, and yet Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. Nobody in the land of Israel had that much faith in Elijah. By this time, he's considered one of the great prophets. By the time of he was alive, that wasn't necessarily so. Remember, Elijah prayed and the Lord shut up rain, and so there was a famine in the land because of their sin. There's lots of folks in Israel, but who offered him food based on faith? Instead, God sent Elijah outside the country to Sidon, a pagan nation, and then to a widow, and she gave him her last meal. That's how it was described. He came to her and said, please give me something to eat. She said, I have nothing but a little bit of in my bowl, a little in my oil in my jar. I was going to make a cake for my son and I, and then we were going to die. He said, please feed me first, and your bowl will never be exhausted, and your oil will never be exhausted until the Lord sends rain. And based on simply that, this woman believed Elijah, fed him first. That's all she had left. Miraculously, God did keep that bowl, never ran out of the flour. The oil never ran out until after it rained. But it was a Gentile, a Sidonian, that believed Elijah. Nobody in Israel did that for Elijah. If they fed him, it's because they had still a lot left. Would they believe him based on faith? The second example is Elisha. He is the successor of Elijah, also considered to be one of the greatest prophets, but not necessarily treated so during his life. Jesus said there were many lepers in Israel in the time of Elisha the prophet. None of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. In 2 Kings 5, it talks about this guy, Naaman. He is the captain of the guard for the king of Aram. Aram was an enemy of Israel. Again, pagan, Gentiles. Naaman had a servant girl, a captured Jewish servant girl, apparently fairly young. Naaman has leprosy. And the Jewish servant girl keeps telling him, "Master, I know if you would go to Elisha, the prophet in Israel, he would heal you." Well, finally, what does he have to lose? He goes down to see Elisha. Actually, he sends a note to the king first, saying that, "I expect you to heal," and the king's upset is, "How am I going to heal a guy? I can't heal leprosy," because the king can't. But he goes to Elisha. Elisha doesn't even come out of his house. Messenger comes in, tells him what Naaman wants. Elisha sends a messenger out and tells him, "Go wash in the Jordan River 7 times. Naaman at this is in a rage. The rivers in Aram are better than here in Israel. But he was reminded, hey, if he asked you to do some great thing, would you do that? Naaman humbled himself and went to the Jordan River and did as Elisha said and was cleansed miraculously. Were there no other lepers in the world at that time? Were there no lepers in Israel at that time? Naaman, a Gentile, pagan, takes the word of a Jewish servant girl, travels all the way down to see Elisha, humbles himself, and does what he says. He believed him. But all the lepers in Israel, not one of them, bothered to go to Elisha and even ask. Jesus' point, 2 points, pretty simple. First, he is aware that they do not accept and believe his claims. Though it's already been proven, miracles have already been done, they've already heard about them. They've already confessed that themselves. "We have heard what you did in Capernaum. Do it here now." We have to see with our own eyes. And second, the point that got them upset, they would not see any kind of miracle they wanted because they were like their ancestors and did not recognize the prophet that was among them. The truth of what Jesus said was then borne out in their response. Look at verse 28. "And all the people in the synagogue were filled with rage as they heard these things, and they got up and drove him out of the city and led him to the brow of the hill on which their city had been built in order to throw him down the cliff." Their angry response is attempted murder. It revealed their evil and wicked hearts. They did not want to be compared to the failure of their ancestors, and even more so, they do not want to be compared to God's graciousness extended to Gentiles. They thought God was only for themselves. That enraged them. This comparison. "You are like your failed ancestors." And the idea that this rabbi would extend grace to Gentiles, as has done by previous prophets. Interesting. These people had gathered on that Sabbath to hear the word of God, to hear it explained. They gathered to worship God. And in a moment, they are turned into a mob filled with rage and murder. How fickle the crowd. Drive them out of the synagogue, out of the city, to the edge of the cliff near the city. The clear intention, throw him off, kill him. But isn't that the way people are? Fickle. They're fickle. Only a few moments before, they're speaking well of him. You know, just because someone says something doesn't make it true, nor is it always a reflection of their actual beliefs. They were happy with Jesus until they did not get what they wanted. And then they rapidly changed, revealing the truth about how selfish they were and their murderous hearts. That's the truth about them. And it's still true for so many today. They can speak nice things about Jesus. They may even claim to be a Christian as long as life is going well and they're getting what they want. But when something bad happens, when they don't get what they want, it can change rapidly. Suddenly, instead of praising God, they're cursing God. They're blaming God. They become hateful. They fail to recognize their own anger and hatred toward God is utter foolishness. It's unbelief. Do they really believe that they can take out their vengeance on God and hurt him? Doesn't that reveal how puny they think God is? Well, they'll be disappointed, just as the folks in Nazareth were, because verse 30 states, "But passing through their midst, he went his way." Their intent was murder. And though they were a mob, they could not kill Jesus. They wanted to. They were trying to. They couldn't kill him. He let them go so far in demonstrating their intentions, but when Jesus decided it was time to leave, he simply passed through their midst, went on his way. So you're a mob. They could not control him. Because God does what he wants, when he wants, in the way he wants, anytime he wants, in keeping with his character, his purposes, and his promises. That's why it's so important to know his character. His character, what assures us his promises will be kept. His promises is an assurance of what the future does hold and how we're supposed to be acting and what God will do. Jesus would not die until he was ready to lay down his life by his own will, on his own initiative, at the proper time, in the proper place, by the proper method, for the proper purpose. Until then, though there were many attempts on his life, no one could kill him. You see, no man can control God. That includes you. Getting angry at God only reveals your ignorance of his identity, nature, and character, and his purposes. God is good. We live in a sin-cursed world, and we bear consequences of our sin, other people's sin, and just the fact it is cursed. But God has a plan, and it's a good plan. And he extends his grace in so many different ways. And in a lot of ways, we will not recognize until we're with him in eternity. We will not know even the purposes. Hebrews talks about a good father chastening his children. God chastens us, even those who belong to him. The hardships he'll put a non-Christian through to wake them up and get their attention are part of mercy, because God is capable of even using that which is evil for his own benefits and praise. You need to know the character of God. Getting angry at him, again, just reveals an ignorance of him. It also reveals a wickedness and evil in your own heart. But our God can change that too, can't he? Do not be like the people of Nazareth. It only results in your own condemnation. Be like the royal official. He sought Jesus because he knew he was compassionate, believed him when Jesus gave his word. Be like the Samaritans who believed what they learned, and they then sought out to Jesus to learn more. That is the response we need to have. You don't have to know everything about him now, but are you seeking him?